This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everyone, this is your host Clint Locklear for Trapping Across America. It's October something or another. It is really starting to feel like trapping season. I haven't gave up my shorts yet and my Crocs, but I've had to put on some fleece coats and stuff in the morning. It's just been really cool. The leaves are starting to change down here, which kind of puts things in different perspective at the time of the year, which everybody that listens to the show knows exactly what I'm talking about on that. And it's a cool time of the year, because it seems like the adrenaline gets to pumping just a little bit inside of you, and you know that trapping season is about here. Now, some of y'all in certain states, I believe, are already trapping, which is cool. But it's for me here, that's not going to happen. I am going to be trapping next week. I'm going up to Michigan. I'm going to be doing some episodes for Freedom Brand Outdoors for their show on cable TV. I don't know if it's going to be one or two episodes. I believe it's two. And I'm going to be trapping raccoon with the Freedom Brand Dog Proof Traps, the one and two, talking about a lot of different techniques and ways that I use those things to catch a bunch of raccoons. So I'm really excited about that. And before I go any further on that, it's going to be a crazy schedule because I'm going to have to get up there. I'm going to have to set up a line. Well, I'm going to find a line, set up a line, run the line, have Allen Probes with the TV camera and stuff there. So it's going to be very, very tight. And I know there's been a lot of you guys that said, if you ever get up here, you know, stop in, you know, we'd go have dinner. I wish I could, but on this trip, it's just going to be, I mean, go, 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 go. And that's just the way that these things are, because there's so much that has to be done on these shows so it doesn't stretch it out for the cost of doing a TV show like that. So it's going to be crazy as far as just the pace when I'm up there. So I'm pretty much going to have to just do my thing when I'm up there with the TV show and crew. So if you're up in that area, and you know, I thought maybe we could get together maybe next time, but this trip's just going to be way too crazy for that. I do want to talk about Iron Curtain. Now, this is one of those things, guys, that you need to learn if you're going to be in business. When we started the Iron Curtain, which is a spray-on product that you put on your dirt so water doesn't penetrate it, so it can't freeze and it doesn't get all muddy. And me and Jeff's been working on it. Jeff Dunlap's been working on this project. Extremely excited about it. We've been testing and trying to figure out some way that the stuff's not going to work. I did some more tests today. One of the chemicals in that product was discontinued by a certain company. And this was after I've already put stuff out on Facebook, I've already talked about it on Trapping Radio. It was completely blindsided to me and Jeff. So what we found out is, just like any essential oils, or just like lure and bait or anything like that, or fish oils or whatever it is, just because something says something doesn't mean that it reacts and is in the same concentrate form. So we've been at a hair pulling couple of weeks trying to find something inside those chemicals that'll give us the same exact consistency that we were getting with what I'm calling Iron Curtain and what Jeff's going to call dry as a bone. So it's not there yet. And this is kind of, I mean, I knew for sure in my heart when I started putting this stuff on Facebook and talking about it, that it wasn't going to be any problem whatsoever. And all of a sudden, it was just like a great big old bulldozer just ran a slap over. And that's just life. That's just part of being in business, and that's part of trying to do something that's on the cutting edge. I'm so excited about this, just for the simple fact, I know there's a lot of you guys out there that likes whack dirt. Go knock yourself out, mix that stuff up, and do that. But for me personally, one of the biggest reasons that I wanted this product, so if I go out of state somewhere, I can take the chemical with me. I can mix it up with the dry dirt that I find there and go to use it. And it also allows me, no matter what time of year it is, that I can mix this stuff up. Well, pretty much wherever I'm at, even here. I mean, I'm doing this in a spare bedroom, because there's not an odor factor. You can do 50 pounds of dirt, 40 pounds of dirt, whatever you're going to be doing, and it's just really quick. You spray it on, I'm putting it on a tarp, I'm mixing it up, letting it dry back out, and I'm going out and using it. So the convenience of it. So it's like bringing a new technology to trapping. Well, just like bringing a new technology to anything, there's going to be bumps in the road, and this is one of them. Now, I'm recording this show. It is 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. So this show will air tonight. We have, I believe, if my math is not wrong, we'll have enough of the Iron Curtain to be able to send out I don't know about tomorrow, but I'll be able to get some out tomorrow. But what I'm going to do for, and I'm not putting this anywhere else except on Trappin' Radio. So when Trappin' Radio comes on tonight, you will be able to go to Wolfer Nation on the PGC store. And under, I'm going to put it somewhere where someone's not going to look. So let's put it under apparel. Under the apparel part of that, because we don't have anything on there right now, I'm going to have Iron Curtain. It'll be a half gallon mixture, limit 2 per customer only, and when we run out, and I'm going to know exactly how many it is. I believe we're going to have like 64 or 65 of the half gallons jugs. They won't have labels on the bottle, they won't have anything like that, which may become more clear to you down the road. Certain things, guys, I've got to keep to myself. I mean, I really do, but I don't want to spend money on labels because of something that may happen with this product. So I don't want to go out and buy labels for this. So if you order this, it's going to be $20 for a half gallon jug. That'll do 50 pounds of dirt. And the way that you do this, the way that I've done this, it works very well, is I went to Tractor Supply and they have these little bitty air sprayers like you would use for your garden. But they have a small half gallon one. It's like $6.50. And you buy that, you pour out the Iron Curtain into the mixer, you get 50 pounds of soil, sift it out so you don't have big chunks of rocks and stuff that you'll have to sift that out your set later. Put that on a tarp. It can be inside if it's still somewhat warm, you know, outside. We hadn't been mixing it up in freezing temperatures because we haven't had freezing temperatures to do that. So I would do it. You can do it in your house, you can do it in a shop, you can do it in a barn. If you know somebody that's got hoop houses or something like that that's in the garden, go ask them if you can just put them in the corner. I'm putting the 40, 50 pounds of sifted dry soil. It needs to be dry before you start the product, really dry. I'm putting it on the tarp. I'm spraying it till it looks really wet on top, not soaking wet, but just moist. And then I'll take an edge of the tarp and kind of fold it up, and the dry stuff will flip on top of the wet stuff, and I spray it down. And I just keep repeating that process until the whole half gallon is in the soil, the sifted soil that's there. And then I spread it back out and I just let it dry. And once it's dry, you go use it. You don't have to do anything else to it. So if you get this, you're not going to have instructions on the bottle. You may have to come back to this show and listen to that again, but it's real easy. You just take 40 to 50 pounds of sifted bone dry soil, spray this on with a little garden sprayer. I mean, you could do it in this little hand sprayer, you know, like it just take longer to do that, but the little pump up ones are easy, only like $6. You spray it on the dirt, and then you let it dry back out. You can put a fan on it, whatever you want to do. And then just go use it. And once you go out and use it, you'll see why I'm so excited about this product. One thing to keep in mind about this or anything else, I guarantee you there will be a trapper out there that'll find some way to make this stuff where it won't work. I don't know what they're going to do exactly, but it will happen. Nothing is 100%. Wax dirt is not 100%. The cool thing about this over the wax dirt is it doesn't absorb odors. And not absorbing odors is a big deal, because if you're buying your wax from somewhere that's got lure in their building, it smells like lure. That's the reason when you look at almost all perfumes and all lotions and stuff like that, it has perfumer's wax in it, which is a variation of paraffin wax and soy wax and carnauba wax and beeswax, because wax absorbs odor and holds it. And that's one of the things I've never liked about wax dirt. I have it in the back of the truck. It's in a bucket. I've got the lid, you know, off of it, off and on. I've got dead critters and lure and, you know, the way a truck smells after a couple of months of trapping. And the dirt starts smelling like that, and you could get some issues. You won't have that with Iron Curtain. So that's one of the reasons I'm excited about it. It's really simple to use. The only thing that I'm gonna say is if you order this product and you use this product, keep in mind what you're trying to do with the product. You're trying to keep the soil dry so it'll shed water. But if you make a step down set where the water's gonna pool on top of it and you get cold weather, the water's gonna freeze on top of it and cause ice. This is not something like, there's no antifreeze in this whatsoever, just like the wax dirt. So if you make your set, if the trapper makes his set where it's going to hold water, it's still going to freeze on top because the water's still going to be there. So you're going to have shelf ice over your set. So if you're going to be using this product, make level patterns. You know, if you want to really get the full advantage out of it, have one side of it that's a little lower than the other. Think about a very small pitch on a roof. Allow the water to come off of that set. Now, I've let water sit on this, and it doesn't seem to penetrate. Now, eventually, it'll have to get down in that dirt. It's just the way gravity works. So if you're not doing a step down set, just make, you know, and you're not putting it somewhere that water's going to blow through it, then you're going to be fine with this product. You don't have to worry about the animals messing with it or being afraid of it. You'll see that when you go out and use it, it smells like, well, soil or dirt. You don't want to, in my opinion, use something that's got a ton of organic matter in it, because you're going to have bigger openings between the soil. That's why I like the wax dirt is actual dirt and not a peat moss mixture or a potting soil mixture or something like that. You want soil there so it can hook to that and not have great big openings, because if you have a lot of organic matter in your soil, water is going to be able to move around that just because they don't touch. So, you know, a bunch of leaves and sticks and rocks and stuff like that, it could hurt you a little bit. I don't know if it'll hurt you a lot, but it could hurt you a little bit. But the biggest thing is just don't make your sets where it's going to hold water. And, you know, just think about if you're going to build a roof, you want that water to run off of it. And if you're not using iron curtain, you need to think about that anyway. The old adage and the myth that you got to have a little bitty low spot over your pan is exactly what that is a myth. When you go look at the old greats, the old woofers that used to just hammer coyotes, and some of them are still alive, they don't do the little low spot over the trap because they understand how water works at a set. And I know that sounds good and it's kind of catchy when you're watching a demo or a video. If you give them a little spot, they'll put their foot there. It's hogwash, guys. It's absolutely hogwash. A coyote will step on a high spot just as quick as a low spot or a level spot. Go look at their tracks going down a road. They don't hopscotch around looking for the low spot to put their foot. It's just one of those things that's been said so many times in trapping, it's been believable. But when you look at the old woofers, they have level trap patterns over their trap, and they always have a way for the water to come off of them. Some of the old sets, like the Charlie Robbins dirt hole set, they allow the water, unless it's a ton of water, to go into the hole. Some of them will have it flat, and if you watch the way they do it, it'll kind of be almost with a small angle going one way or the other. And a lot of these old guys did this without thinking over time when they're talking about it that's what they're doing, just because it becomes such a habit to them over time. Because these guys learned, especially the old woofers that left traps in the ground for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, a month, these old government guys that really were hammering coyotes, they had to take in consideration the weather when they put in their trap. And just because iron curtain is going to give you such a huge advantage over using natural soil that doesn't have it in it, you still want to build your sets to allow the water to run off of it. So that's going to be my little spill. So tonight I'm going to have the exact amount in inventory on the PCG store on Woofer Nation. So it's two per customer, and the shipping is going to be in there. I can get two of those in a flat rate box, or one for a flat rate box, because it's by weight. And we're going to have that up there. When they're gone, they're gone. When we figure this out and I know that it's at the level that this stuff is now where I can put my name on it, and then we'll have it for sale for then on. But until that point, this is it. So if you want to play around with this, this is your chance. I'm keeping a little bit for myself, but I've already told you about it, so I want to get that out there to you to play around with it and just go out and use it. Now, since I'm going to do the TV show early next week, if you're ordering this, you have to stop whatever you're doing right now and listen to me. Cindy's family from Colorado is in. There's a whole herd of kin folks in here. So this weekend is crazy. I'm trying to get ready for the show. I'm trying to get wholesale orders out and retail orders and everything else. I'm going to try to get some of them out tomorrow. I will get some of them out Monday and Tuesday morning, and then I'm gone. Now, if I can't get them all out, and if you're going to order other products, this is not the time to do it. Just order the Iron Curtain. If I can't get it out, I will have Travis where he can package some during the week and have Cindy take them to the post office. But what I'm telling you is, this on this one product, this right now, it may not be the normal shipping quickness that we normal get, just because of the time of year and everything that's going on. And I'm asking for your understanding on this. So it may be 5-6 days before it actually gets in the flat rate postal box. So if you don't get it in 5 days, don't call up asking for a tracking number, because the way the post office does their tracking number, since I actually take the boxes to the postal, if 5 people did that, that's an hour of my time. That's the reason, unless there's an issue, I don't look up tracking numbers. I know that's the norm with Amazon. They're all automated. We're old school when it comes to this. I know some of the bigger trap supply dealers have the tracking number with it. They have a different system, and it doesn't take them any more time to do that. The way the Postal Service and all their great geniusness of the bureaucratic of the government ways of the Postal Service is, I get tracking numbers by a zip code on a receipt, and then I've got to go with that receipt and track down the zip code through the store to find the order, to get the zip code, to be able to match it with a tracking number, and then get that tracking number to you. So realistically, you're talking 15, 20 minutes for me to get a tracking number. If I've got 30 orders a day, 30 times 10, that's 3 hours a day in tracking numbers, I'm not doing that. Because the few times that we do have stuff get lost in the mail, it's easy to fix at that point. So I'm just kind of giving you a heads up on that, so don't get upset. If it's not there in 72 hours and you start asking for a tracking number, it's not going to happen. So if you're going to order this, if you're going to order the Iron Curtain tonight, just there's going to be have to be some leeway going back and forth on this. I want to get it out quick enough so you can make your dirt and go play with it when you need it. If you see a big front's coming in, you can be kind of safe on some of your sets that way. But it's going to have to be some leeway. So I'm just letting you know about that. I'm going to be going over a lot of questions today. And before I do, there is an email I got, which just tickled me to death. And this is from Roy. And there's a website out there called themodernprepper.com. I mean, not Modern Prepper. themodernpredator.com. And he said, "Hey, Clint, I want to drop you an email, let you know personally much enjoy trapping radio and the motivation it provides me as a trapper in my everyday life. Also, there's a link above to a trapping article I wrote for some folks who approached me about writing for them. I met them through Twitter." And that's themodernpredator.com is where you'll find this. "I want to thank you personally because so much of what I've heard about trapping radio has kept me motivated and able to believe that I can do whatever I set my mind to. Hopefully I can also now portray trapping in a positive light. Thanks again for all you do for us, Roy." Dude, congratulations. Most people talk about doing something like this and you went out and done it. So kudos to you. And anybody wants to see it, you can definitely go to it. This is not a trapping per se website. And I'm trying to pull it up right now because it says, "I'm not a writer, I'm a trapper." And there's one little thing at the end that I really like, and it says, "Do not live your fears." And that's pretty cool. So if y'all want to read this, you can go get it at themodernpredator.com. So kudos to you for actually doing it, man, and not being afraid to write, because you'll find out, anybody will find out, the more you write, it's like any skill, the easier it gets. Anybody that needs to build social capital today and you're not willing to write so you can get on search engines and stuff like that, You're making the decision not to be successful. If anybody says, I don't know how to write, then start writing. It's pretty simple. You know, do some reading, find some articles that you enjoy reading. Look how they set them up. Kind of mimic them for a while. You'll get your own style after a while, and it's just like talking. That's the way the internet works. It's very different from it was in school, and I do think a lot of people get vapor locked because you had some school marm sitting there with the ruler wanting to slap it on your desk because you got something out of order or out of whack or didn't meet the diagram just perfectly or something nonsense like that. That's not the way the internet works. In the internet today is people want to read in a language that they speak. And that's not what they taught you in school. I mean, you want to have as good a grammar as you can. Y'all have all seen my writing. I've missed the mark on that. You need to try to have your spelling the best you can. I've got 3 books and I can't spell. So don't let any of that bother you for going out there and doing what you want to do. Okay. Now this next one is multiple questions. There's some personal stuff on here, so I'm not going to read all of it. But it's a question from a gentleman. I'm just going to say Rusty. I'm not going to say where he's from or anything like that. I know coyotes can be trapped extremely hard and can recover back 100% of the population from one season to another. How hard can red and gray fox and cats be trapped? Well, I'm going to have to give you a permaculture answer on this, and it's going to be frustrating, but I think you'll understand why here in a minute. It depends. Now, when we go to Texas, or if we're in an area like here in Tennessee, and say I get 10 farms out of 2 counties, and I really trap those bobcats and fox and gray fox really, really hard, and let's say these farms were on realistically, unless you're somewhere out west or somewhere like Texas where you're dealing with big acreage, in the reality of the wildlife population that is around you, if it's a 500 acre farm and you completely strip every red fox and every bobcat and every gray fox off of that 500 acres, the next year you'll probably have half of what you had before. But the reality is you're probably not going to strip 100% off of that. And the reason that when you talk about trapping out an area, and it's very different when you start talking about beaver, because once you take the animal that's keeping the habitat up, habitat's going to change, and you may or may not have beaver for a year or 5 years or 10 years. But land predators are very different on this. So if you've got, say, 500 acres, and then you, 20 miles down the road, you've got another farm that's 500 acres, and you stripped all of the fur out of that 500 acres. Now, to me and to you, and the way we look at acreage and stuff like that, that seems like a lot, but it's really not in the big scheme of things, and that's where the depends come in. If there's a decent, healthy population spread out across a couple of counties or section of a state, if you go in and you really hammer the animals, it's really not going to make any difference whatsoever unless you do it year after year after year. Because that 500 acres is surrounded by hundreds of thousands of acres where nothing is being done with the animal population. Everybody thinks that there's all kind of competition in trapping. There's way more ground that's not touched than there are that is touched. So really hurting a population is kind of hard. Now, if red fox got up to $300 a piece and everybody on almost all the ground started trapping red fox and gray fox, that would be a drastically different story. But that's not the world we live in. And even with the higher prices a few years ago, it still wasn't that way. I kind of like to look at, I've got to separate predators from predator control and fur trapping. So keep this in mind. The best way that I've heard about it is the way that Red O'Hearn talked about his beaver up in Iowa. He farmed his beaver. he would go and make a judgment call on what was in that area, and he would only take like 20 or 30%, and then he would leave. But every year, he had the same amount of beaver on his beaver lines. So he was looking at just the way a farmer would look if you had a herd of something that you were going to be harvesting. So that's a pretty cool thing, the way to look at this, in my opinion. But unless you're on huge, like, really big pieces of ground, and you're so mechanized and so efficient, you're probably not going to do very much damage at all, because the filter is going to come back in. Now, coyotes, I can tell you that if you take 100% of their population, because of the life cycle of a coyote, because I've seen this on these studies I've done for universities, like when I did the one for Georgia, when we went in there and we took 100% of the coyotes that were living there and that were visiting there, when we did that, there was not a single coyote track on that 1,800 acres the entire next year. The biologist was out there weekly trying to find them. He couldn't find them. But that was so intensive of trapping, that's probably not going to be something that somebody's going to do in a fur way. Just because those last two or three and four coyotes, there was like weeks and weeks in between the catch, and most guys aren't going to hang around that far to do that. The idea that you have as many that come back is a little bit different, depending on the true population of what was there to begin with. Now, that 1,800 acres up there had some very unique features about it that only basically allowed coyotes to come in from two ways, unless they could literally rock climb about 1,800 feet straight up with rappel ropes. So that piece of property was almost an island unto itself. If it was more on the flat ground, I don't think we'd have seen that. But you wouldn't have seen the same amount of coyotes there the next year, because even though 1,800 acres is not a lot of ground, they couldn't filter in that fast because we did 100% complete decimation for the study, because that's the only way to get a true number for the study we were going. And I wouldn't recommend anybody ever doing that in fur trapping, because it's really cutting your own throat. It's like a cattle farmer that's got 10 cows and 10 first year cows, and the price goes up on the cattle, and they go take all their cows to the slaughterhouse. They make some money right then, and now they've got to start over on their herd, and there's nothing left in their pasture. Well, the pasture's going to get out of shape because now he's going to have to start cutting it. And the cows are more expensive on the market, so he's going to have to spend more money to get the same amount of cows that he could have used naturally through reproduction on his own cows. So you've got to think about what you're doing the way a farmer would, and think about long-term instead of short-term. But I don't think you're going to hurt them. And normally, the best way to handle red and gray fox is if you go out and you put in, say you're on 500 acres, and or even 100 acres or whatever it is, you will have certain places on certain times of the year where you'll have fox crossings, and even coyote crossings for that matter. And especially for you guys that's in Maryland, parts of Pennsylvania, you talk to some of those trappers, or you've probably done it yourself, you'll have places, like when I was out at Ron Leggett's, that they'd have a crossing on one farm they would take 23, 25 fox off of, and then it would go dead. And they could do that year after year after year after year until the fox population started going down, but not from trapping. That's not what happened to the fox out there. But those crossings are a little bit different. And if you're going somewhere and you don't have true fox crossings where you have places you can catch, you know, 10 or 15 fox in one single location, you probably don't have the coyote density and the fox density and the gray fox density. So what I would say is, as soon as you see a noticeable difference in the catch, so you go out and you put out some really good sets on some really good locations, and say for a week or so you have a good catch where you're catching several a day, and then it just really slides off and it's just one here, 4 or 5 days later, it's another one there. That's time to pull. Not only from the efficiency part of your expenses, but the population is telling you the cream is gone. And if you've got to really start digging and scratching and hunting to keep catching animals on that property, you're probably going too far and you're going to get in trouble. If you have a bunch of land and you have good populations and you're not having disease, like where I live right now, distemper has been a problem in gray fox, possum, skunks, and raccoons now for about 10 years. So we have a spike in population, and then it'll just be pretty much gone for 3 or 4 years, and it'll slowly come back. But if you're not having something like that where, you know, allows me to, I mean, I just know that if reds and grays start showing up in numbers, I could probably take more, because the way this cycle's been going, they're going to be dead anyway. So you got to keep that in mind. Now, that's the reason there's the pens. There's a lot of things that go into this. But in a normal situation, as soon as your catch starts getting hard, pull it. If you've got enough locations, and this is where gold setting comes in. If you want to catch 100 fox, and whether it be red or gray or a combination of two, I'm going to use that for a number. That seems to be kind of the gold standard of what everybody wants to do as far as, you know, doing it. But it can be any number. It could be 10, 20, whatever you want to do. Kind of have that in place. And if you've got 20 locations and you can catch 5 fox on each major farm or location, when you get those 5 off that property, I would probably pull. That way you have plenty of breeding stock and you don't have to worry about it. Now, some of those will produce and some of them won't. So the smartest way to handle line management when it comes to that is to have more property than you think you need. Have a preset number of what you want to take off per property, then have a reserve amount of property in the back to fill that in. Because every year properties will produce in different ways and in different numbers, and that's where the reserve comes in. It's pretty idealistic and naive to think that if you've got a decent fox population, I've got 10 properties, I need to catch 10 fox per property, that you'll be able to do that on all 10 properties every year. So through line management, if you know what your number is, for one, you kind of know if you're meeting your goal or not, and two, you can farm them a lot better. And if you're going to a new place, then you're really not going to know what the true population is. And then you just fall back to when it starts getting hard, start pulling them. And I'm talking fur trapping now. But for the most part, there's so much untrapped ground and so many, you know, basically quote sanctuaries, just because the way our society is today, I'm not sure that a trapper can do near as much damage as they think they can in the overall scheme of things, just because the world's much bigger than the trapper is living in at that moment. So, you know, kind of keep that in mind. Now, the coyotes, I know, because I'm not going to say where this gentleman is from, but I would say where you're saying you're going to be trapping at, I would try to take every single coyote that you can catch. Show them absolutely, positively no mercy on catch. Because if you don't, in that area where you're saying that you're going to be trapping, you're going to lose your fox in the numbers that you're used to seeing. And you've got to take that into consideration. Where you're talking about trapping, coyotes are not native by any stretch of the imagination. They don't have a population hold there yet. So actually, what the trappers in that area should be doing is having a precise and cohesive program to make sure they never get a hold there. Because it's going to change the ecosystem in a way you're probably not going to like. So, but I'm not going to say exactly why that is, but for you personally that I'm reading this to, 100% no mercy on coyotes. And then you manage your fox. Because if you don't keep the coyotes out of where you're at, you're not gonna have the red or gray numbers that you think you do. And I'm gonna go down. He's got an A under this. I've been releasing all female bobcats and only keep my fox traps out for about a week. I run my line out of a boat each side of the river. I've been kind of guessing that I should be getting about one gray per mile or one red per 3 miles and one bobcat per 5 miles. Now, that's an interesting way to look at this. The grays, one per mile, I would say that's probably pretty realistic, because what you're going to have, at least in my experience with grays, now there's places like North Carolina and things that I've seen a lot higher gray populations than I'm used to dealing with here in Tennessee and in the mountains. So keep that in context. But most of the time here, if I'm on a 100-acre place and I set out traps, I catch two gray fox and it's over. But most of the time I'll catch two gray fox there every year. But I don't keep the traps there pretty much past the two, because it's so long for the other gray fox show up. So in that one gray per square mile, you're always going to be leaving part of a breeding pair, which makes sense to me. So that makes perfectly good sense. Now, where you're talking about trapping one red per 3 miles, I think is spreading yourself out or not giving the red fox population credit, unless you're just not seeing any red fox. Even here where we do have red fox, I can catch a lot more than that up next to cities and on the banks of the river here, where they get up close to towns and stuff where the coyotes aren't messing with them too bad. And this one red per 3 miles, I think, is a little bit spreading yourself too thin. I think you could definitely take that. I would say you could probably bring that up to 5 red fox, maybe even 10 red fox per 3 miles on a river, because that's a lot longer in a river than it is, and a lot more territory covered than it is out of a road. And you probably wouldn't hurt that. Now, if you get out of the boat and you have trouble catching any reds, then I would leave them alone. And one bobcat per 5 miles is going to depend a lot on your bobcat population. And that's going to depend, for anybody else that's listening, really where you're at the particular time that you're trapping. One bobcat here in Tennessee per 5 miles, bobcat population wouldn't even know that I was in the world. There's more than that. In most of the Southeast, Texas, the bobcat numbers, I would say if you're in Texas, would be one bobcat per square mile. In Tennessee, I would expect in 5 square miles in decent ground here in Tennessee would be 5 to 10 bobcats, and I'm still not hurting the population in 5 miles. But see, I don't know what your cat population is where you're talking about trapping. I don't really hear about people trapping bobcats, so that may be more realistic to where you're at. You know, and a lot's going to do on sign of what you're doing. But what you're going to find is that you're going to have pockets of bobcats depending on terrain and food. And just the way the land rolls around those rivers, that you may have 20 miles of no bobcats, and then 3 or 4 miles that there'll be dozens of bobcats. So you're going to have to make that decision on what that is. I mean, if you went off of this formula, you definitely wouldn't be hurting the population. I mean, that's absolutely the truth. I think the grays is probably right on. I think you're too low on your red catch, and I have no idea on your bobcats, just because I don't know that area or what is there. You know, releasing the female bobcats, and if you're in an area that's got low numbers of bobcats, that's a very smart thing to do. I mean, that's just being a grown-up trapper is what that is. You know, you turn them loose. Even if the bobcats are bringing good money, think about the cattle farmer that's cutting his own throat. Now, if there's a lot of females, which there are in a lot of areas, we're keeping some of them is not going to be any big deal, now you're going to have to take the line management to a higher level to be able to understand what you should or should not be doing. Genetics in animals are just like they are in anything else. You're never going to take a South Georgia deer and get the genetic potential that you have in South Texas. You can take that deer to South Texas, but it'll take generations and generations to get that genetic, even where it's somewhat similar. So, you know, genetics in animals is a real thing. That's why you have certain places, like my coyotes here in Squatchy, in Bledsoe County, in Grundy County, are actually a lot more decent of coyotes than they are if I go 50 miles from here. Genetically, they're better colored. They have a lot wider bellies, and they don't have as many crazy woolly type things that happen to them. That's genetically here for whatever reason. And now when I go into, you know, like even 100 miles from here into North Alabama, there is some butt ugly coyotes down there compared to what I'm used to seeing here. And there's parts of the Midwest on the eastern side that those coyotes genetically pass for western coyotes are low-grade western coyotes every single year. It's a genetic thing of where they're at and the environment that they're in. So you keep that in mind. Now with your bobcats, if you're going to take your line management up to get out of just going to trap some animals, what I would look for is, even though it may hurt you a little bit on income right now, I would get the ugly females out of the population if you have a high enough females for that to happen. And you may not where you're at. But I would definitely turn loose the really smoking hot, nice spotted, white-bellied, grayish, bluish female bobcats. Turn them loose. You want those genes in your population. You know, one of the things that aggravates me, and I'm going to go on a small rant here, is you have places like Texas that has just amazing genes. I mean, amazing genes. And those people are killing bobcats left and right down there just because there's so many of them that get concentrated on certain animals because of the wildlife practices they do in Texas. That you can go down back roads. If you wanted to have a day just to make yourself feel sick, drive down to South Texas. Go down about an hour south of San Antonio and drive any direction you want. I don't care what it is, just drive a direction. Get off the main road where you're on the dirt roads and the farm roads, and you can drive for 8 hours. I mean, Texas is a huge state. And start looking at the fence. You drive 8 hours, you will see a couple of hundred rotted bobcats in the fence because the ranchers don't care anything about the fur and the genetics are in those cats. Now, if a state was actually trying to support the sportsmen that support them, they could work a program out with either private trappers or the state or the government trappers or somebody. It wouldn't be that difficult. Pay somebody $50 more or $100 more for the fur value of those cats. Let them catch them in cages or be very particular about the ones that are foot caught. Leave the snares in the truck. Catch those cats and bring them to different states like Tennessee and Georgia and West Virginia and Pennsylvania and places like that that have decent fur quality, good size, but no spots, and very little white belly cats. And instead of just having brown back or rabbit back bobcats, you could start bringing in some of the blues and grays. And genetically, by bringing those cats in, just like they do with everything else, just like they bring in the turkeys and the fisher they've done here in Tennessee and the elk and everything else, it's no different. but they're doing it to support the sportsmen. But for some reason, they either too short-sighted or they're too lazy to do this with bobcats. If you were to bring in those bobcats, make sure there's no crazy diseases in them, put them in quarantine, have the vet look them over, check them out, turn those things loose, you can actually, through genetics, really ramp up the value of the cats that are in a particular area by bringing in different genes. But getting back to the question, ugly female bobcats, if you've got enough of them to matter, I would go ahead and pull those out of the gene pool. And the really cool looking, spotted up, leopard looking females with the good looking bellies, release those, even if you're gonna lose money that particular year, because you gotta think more long term in your trapping if you're gonna, you know, be a true steward of wildlife. Turn those back in the population. You know, and that's part of the reason Texas has a gene pool it has. If the deer is not doing what it's supposed to, it goes to the food bank. No questions asked. If it's not a quick start at doing that, it's out of the gene pool. And I think the trapping industry could look at certain things like that too. You know, I mean, really. Would it have mattered if you brought in fox from Tennessee to somewhere like Maryland where you have a massive fox population where you could start through the genes of Georgia and Tennessee and Mississippi and parts of Missouri and Kentucky where you have true, or even Pennsylvania on the western side for that matter, if you had true cherry red fox and you started releasing that into the gene pool at an enough rate that they would start breeding some of the straw and the yellowness out of the Maryland fox, think of how much more valuable of an asset in the wild running around that would be than there is now. Those fox would probably double in value. Of course, without going on another tangent, the government really doesn't give a crap if the individual person makes more money or not. But if they did, that's what they would do if they are actually managing wildlife. Because human beings actually are an amazing animal where we can, through positive change, make our environments better. And that is one way to do that. And we can have better populations and more valuable populations, just like a cattleman gets rid of bad genes in cows and keeps the good genes, and eventually he's got a very expensive bull that everybody wants the genes from. We should be doing that inside of the fur industry. I don't know if it'll ever happen. But that's one of the things that drives me crazy, because I would love to have the gene pool of Texas bobcats here in Tennessee and in different places. Okay, now under this one, we've got a bee. I'm scared of overtrapping, and knowing you do predator control and overtrapping as possible, what are you shooting for? I figured you know how quick farms repopulate after being trapped. Well, it's gonna, like I said, it's gonna fall back a lot on what your actual population is. You know, it took us 4 years in Texas on 20,000 acres to actually hurt that population, and we're taking between 70 and 100, 120 bobcats, 300 to 500 coyotes, and 300 to 500 raccoons off 20,000 acres. It literally took 4 years before that started showing up. Well, I mean, if you figure that amount out, that's what, say 400 bobcats, keeping on the low side on the coyotes, to say 300, that's 1,200 coyotes and 1,200 raccoons off 20,000 acres before we actually saw any type of major decline. But around that place, no one else traps. And what you'll find in that type of situation is probably 70% of the animals that'll be caught there this year will be in the edges around the property and not so much in the center. But they're still trying to breed in. Now, we didn't trap that last year, and I have a feeling the numbers in 1 year, giving it a break, will be what it was when we were never there, because the outside of our area is completely untouched, even on 20,000 acres. And I understand the thing about being scared of over trapping. That is one thing that I do think the trapping industry is missing the mark on is actual fur management. I don't know if it's possible to have trappers actually agree on what that is, because you don't know what the next farm's doing as far as the trapper goes. You don't know if he's over trapping or under trapping or what's going on. I mean, I really don't know how that works. I will say that for the most part, in all parts of the country, short of maybe a few in certain areas, there's not enough trappers taking enough fur to make a difference. There's just not enough trappers out there. Now, you may see some little things that happen on individual farms, but they will come back pretty quick unless you're also hammering what's around there. So, you know, one way you could make sure that you're not over trapping your area is spread your farms out in more of a linear fashion or a circular fashion or a cross, you know, type thing on a map. So instead of, if you have one farm, we'll say that's farm A, and farm B, C, and D are not surrounding that farm. But if farm B was 5 miles up the road in a linear fashion and you trapped it, and then there was another one out from that and you trapped it, you're probably not going to hurt that population at all. You know, it's just a reality. There's not enough fur harvesting going on to even matter to that. You'll have bigger swings in the animal population as far as food and disease and you know, getting run over by cars and different things like that than you are by actually trapping. But I do think that's very smart for a trapper to be thinking this way. So, you know, smaller farms, if no one else is really hammering around you, you're probably not going to do anything at all to the local population besides just what's on that farm, and it'll fill in pretty easy. Now, when you hear me talking about predator control, like the study down in Georgia, keep in mind that was a 9-month process. I mean, I went in there like a banshee and trapped everything I could, and then I would pull out. 3 or 4 weeks later, I'd go in there like I've never been there before and set just as many traps, and I would pull out. And this cycle repeated and repeated and repeated itself. And in fur trapping, that's just not going to be, the fur season's not long enough. And if you're somewhere for 2 weeks, you're never going to be able to do what we did on that study, because the man hours and the expense of doing that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I hope that helped you on the questions. I know that was sporadic and it was all over the place, but it's a great question. I mean, that is a very thoughtful way to look at trapping, and I think we ought to do that more often. And not only for the animals, guys, the reason we need to look at it that way, but because if we started really looking at things that way, look at the difference of perception with the public and trapping. If management was really a big, if it's used the word ethic here, it was a big ethic of trapping, where that was really discussed and talked about, and some studies were done on it, and working with states on that, different things like that. Look at the perception with the soccer moms, if that's one of the things that was very prominent inside of trapping. Now, it is to certain people, and it may be to a biologist, but that's not the perception to a soccer mom when, and I'll use myself as an example, she comes across, you know, my Facebook page or Wolfer Nation, and she didn't know there's that many bobcats in the world, and she sees them stacked up on the ground. You know, it's the perception there is greatly different, and perception wins wars all the time. And if trapping's gonna stay the way that we want it to stay, we gotta start thinking strategically about perception with the public. It's easy just to go, screw them, I don't care what they think, they're stupid, they don't understand nature. All of that could be true, and most of it is. But there's more them than there is us. And in a voting population type way, that could get in trouble. that's one of those things that I really think that the NTA and the FTA should be doing more of, is strategically having ways that people come across what is so positive about trapping, instead of relying on trappers to do that, because that's what they're getting funding for. And I'll give you some examples. Do you know what it would cost the NTA to run YouTube channels? Because people like me, I definitely put them on my website. I would definitely allow them to even upload to my Wolfer Nation YouTube channel, which is what, got 2.5, 3 million views by now. I would let them do that, as long as it wasn't a money call for the NTA. But if it was a something like Define the Myth type thing, and it doesn't have to be done as professionally as that, just interviewing biologists and stuff like that. If that's what I think in the world that we live in today, what part of the NTA and the FTA's true contribution to trapping could be, is to use all the platforms out there where there's very little income involved from their point, and they get to interact and just get people to think a little bit different. Because the way that you get someone to be on the fence about something is pretty simple. If someone just thinks something is evil, and all of a sudden they see something that thing they thought was pure evil is actually doing good, it takes them off guard a little bit, and they won't be so quick to pull a trigger to hurt something when they know that there's good being done with that. And YouTube channels, I do not know why the NTA didn't have a podcast. I do not know why they don't have, I mean, their website, don't take this the wrong way, if you're in the NTA, guys, that website sucks. That is a website for trappers. You're a public organization that's supposed to be doing outreach to other people also. You should be, at minimum, asking people to write articles about how good and different things that trappers are doing, as far as bringing animals to zoos and wildlife management, and talking to biologists that are favorable to that, and putting that stuff up there so it ranks on Google. So when people are looking up certain subjects about why is my house cat coming up missing, and you can talk about all the different ways that coyotes and stuff like that are eating people's pets, and then the pet owner can see, holy cow, that's a problem, but these guys are trying to help us. That, to me, is what should be on that website, more than the NTA fund driving and trying to figure out ways to generate income. It's also to outreach to other people. And you may be saying, well, how come you don't do that, Clint? Well, I do it some, but I'm in the business of trapping. I'm not in the business of outreaching for trapping. That's what a 501c3 with the Fur Bears Unlimited is about, and that's what the nonprofit of the NTA and the FTA is for. It shouldn't fall down on business owners inside the trapping industry, because we pay a huge percentage of what they have to fund with anyway. It should be left up to the people there to be creative, not do what they've just done since 1970, and outreach to people. And there's so many different ways to do it now that it would cost them so less money. That's what I'd like to see. Because if you did a whole series on biologists talking about the importance of trapping and managing wildlife, and what happens if we don't manage wildlife, it's a lot different than when someone sees something about trapping. It could be in a positive light instead of just a negative PETA, Humane Society, bloodthirsty, knuckle-dragging people that get off on killing animals, which is absolutely false. That's what the NTA should be doing, and the FTA, in my opinion. But I'm going to stop on that, because I can rant on that for a long time. Now, this is the second part of the question. When I travel back to Nebraska, it's always in December. Very cold winters, 6 inches of frost. Do you have any tips on dealing with frost? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and read his underpinnings. And I would snare to get around this, but I can't snare all the properties. Also thought about throwing a bunch of sidewalk de-icer a few days prior in a 5x5 area where I intended to make my set. I also thought putting grass clippings at the bottom of the trap bed during the summer months. Right now, my method is taking an axe chip out of bed, bring a lot of dry dirt with me to blend in the set. Okay, this is something, this is a problem. And this is part of the reason that I love, and this is not a sales pitch, but that I wanted from a business point of view, guys, I'm just being straight up and honest with you. This is a major problem with a lot of trappers. And this is why me and Jeff have spent so much time trying to figure out an easier way to waterproof dirt where it doesn't freeze. Which is a good business lesson for anybody, because this I get questions like this all the time. And jokingly, most time I say there's these things called roads that head south. You know, but in all reality, that's not true for most people. I'm just saying that kind of off cuff, just kind of, you know, go south and you don't have to deal with it. Which is what I do when I'm fur trapping for money, because it allows me to make more money because I don't have to deal with it. But the Iron Curtain is filling a niche to help a trapper's life better. And that's why I get so excited about this. And it's not why I picked this question. I actually like the management questions better. But that's one option. The other option is dry dirt. The issue with dry dirt is you're going to have, and I saw where you're going to be at to where you're going to Nebraska from. That's a long freaking way to be carrying 55-gallon drums of dirt, enough to make any difference. But you can do dry dirt. And there are ways to do wax dirt on location, but the equipment you're going to need to take for that makes it just unrealistic, because you're talking blow torches and concrete mixers and all kind of stuff, which is not what most people want to be doing during trapping season. So that's the reason we come up with the Iron Curtain concept, because the niche and the need of and is going to be filled with people with this product, so their life is so much better. That's what I get excited about a product like Iron Curtain with. It's filling such a big niche that's going to make so many trappers' life easier that it's just super cool to me, to be honest with you. But let's get back to this question. 6 inches of frost. I'm assuming you're meaning 6 inches of frozen ground. Dude, that's tough. Now, it's not as tough. Now, Nebraska, in certain areas, I believe you start getting into more... I'm not going to say desert per se, but not as much moisture like you have in the east, which dry dirt then can get you a lot farther. So like even if I go to a job now and it's somewhere it's more humid, say South Carolina, I know that pretty much if I'm within 2 hours of the coast, I can go under any bridge and get all of the dry dirt that I want off of the road, and it's going to be a big sandy mixture and it's going to be bone dry, and I can just put that in buckets on a daily basis, and as I'm running my lines I can bed into that stuff. I may add some peat moss or grass clip, something to give it a little organic texture, and as long as it doesn't rain and it gets really cold, it really doesn't matter, because there's trust me, I know more about waterproofing and how water soil works now than I've ever known in my life. Probably too much than any human being needs to know. But soil, a really, really dry soil will retard moisture up to a point. Just because the water, when it hits that really dry soil, water has a film on it. The molecules do, and it'll kind of float around, and if it has a chance to run off of something, it will. That's why when you see you go to a cornfield, I'm not picking on corn farmers at all today, guys, not none at all, but it's just a lesson in dry dirt. If you go to a cornfield that's being disturbed a lot with plowing, and they use a lot of herbicides, so it kills off all the organic matter. What you will see when it rains is the water will hit it, and it'll sit on top for a long time, and then it'll and then you'll have this really fine particles of dust that'll come back and coat it. And then the when the water hits that again, that'll almost act like some type of waterproofing agent in of itself, and it'll flow off of there, which is where a lot of the erosion and stuff happen, because all that water eventually picks up steam. But really dry dirt can handle a little bit of normal moisture before the water can penetrate it, especially stuff that's been disturbed and mixed up a lot, like under a bridge, and it's bone dry under there unless there's been a flood or something. So if you're somewhat in a dry, cold climate, dry dirt can really, really help you out. Now, where that hurts you in the east is we get rain in the fall and winter, it seems like every 2 or 3 days. But if you have enough of this stuff to get to, you just scoop out the wet stuff and put in the dry stuff, and you can kind of keep rolling that way. But, you know, dealing with, because I think Nebraska, and it depends on where you're at in Nebraska, really, you know, if that's going to matter or not. But, you know, I would snare around this, but I can't snare all properties. And that's the way it is going to be for pretty much anywhere you go. If you got frozen ground and you can go to snares, that is the way to go. It is without a way to go. And if I was somewhere that had 6 inches of frozen ground and it was legal for me to snare, I would run a snare line and then back up only where I needed with foothold traps, period. I wouldn't go any further than that. But there are going to be places, there's just not enough cover. You could have cattle, you could have deer, stuff like that you got to worry about. So the snaring could be out. But that would definitely be my first option every single time, because the snare doesn't care how frozen the ground is. And you'll learn if you really push your snaring, really, really push your snaring, you can figure out there's a lot of ways that you can catch animals in not optimum conditions for snaring that you can still pick up a good amount of numbers, which comes with, you got to keep pushing it about how far in open ground you can go. So that's going to be up to the snare person, not to always think about just the perfect spot, but put out a bunch of snares and see what happens and learns from it. Now, he's also thought about throwing a bunch of sidewalk de-icer a few days over a 5x5 area. Something else that I've learned since I've been into all this research is de-icer only works to a certain point. And most de-icers are going to stop working probably about 10 or 15 degrees. Because once the moisture that is in the air gets that into a liquid form inside the dirt and it thaws out, it turns into salt water. Salt water will start freezing unless the concentration is extremely high at about 25, 28 degrees. And I bet Nebraska gets a whole lot colder than that in December. So it could work on a short time basis, but it's probably not going to work over a long-term basis. And if I was going to actually go with this route, you know, and I wouldn't buy a sidewalk de-icer unless you can get it cheaper than table salt, because that's what it is. If you go to the co-op, I mean, de-icer is nothing but sodium, which is salt. You can go to a co-op, especially in farm country, and you can buy great big bags of salt for next to nothing. But if the de-icer is cheaper, I would go that route, because it's all the same. It's just salt. But I wouldn't do it ahead of time unless it was just going to be right where the actual trap set was going to be, just so you could work the trap in. And then I would cover the area, if you're going to go this route, the day of that you're putting in the set. Because I don't think you're going to gain anything over a bigger area like that, except where the trap is at, just so you can dig in a trap bed, possibly. But guys, keep in mind, when I was in Alaska, I trapped on top of the snow at 20 below zero, which was pretty much the warmest it got in the winter. We didn't have freeze and thaw. And with 5 and 7 foot of snow, you didn't go down to the ground. So I'm kind of limited on this. And where I live in Tennessee, about every other year, I've got to go to something besides glycerin because of we only have maybe a week a year where it's going to actually be down to close to 0 degrees, and then I go to pure table salt at the set. So I don't have as much experience with dealing in that type of environment, just to be honest with you, that I can give you good advice on. Salt, definitely, the colder it is, salt starts becoming about the only option unless you have a dry material. And he's thought about putting grass clippings in the bottom of his trap bed during the summer months. I will tell you, one of the things that the old woofers used to do, which I think would work better than grass clippings, you need to be a little bit careful with this where you're not getting it on your hands and eating your lunch, because you could get pretty sick. But if you go like out in where they have cattle, especially if there's any dairy farms or where people are putting up horses or anything like that, the old woofers, or even chicken houses for that matter, the nitrogen inside of manure is very, very hot. It's actually a green manure. And it produces heat. And what the old woofers used to do is they would go out and they would actually use manure to bed their traps in, because it would produce heat for several days actually around the trap. Now if you mix that with salt, I'm not sure what if it would still continue to heat up like that, because of salt may kill the organisms that's actually making the heat. But you could try it. Grass clippings in the summer, I'm not sure if that's going to help you in anything, but it could be something. If you used peat moss with grass clippings over the set, you could definitely handle some really cold weather if you're using dry peat moss. And the peat moss, because it doesn't absorb moisture quickly, it'll stay dry. And then if you didn't put dirt over the set where it would freeze, the dirt is not there to freeze, and the grass clippings pretty much can, because it's fibrous, and if you have it in small pieces, the foot of a coyote or a fox or anything can definitely, that little bit of crust, they'll break through and push down on the peat moss, which will fire their trap. So I would kind of look at going with peat moss with clippings over the top, you know, to be honest with you, and over trying to put grass clippings in the bottom, because I'm not sure exactly where that's going to help you, because that grass will eventually freeze once the ground around it freezes too. And if it's got moisture in there, it's just going to be frozen grass. Right now my method is taking an axe to chip out of bed and bringing a lot of dry dirt with me to blend the set in. If you're not getting a lot of moisture, that's the simplest way to go. You know, if you're not going to be using a product or something to do that with, you know, to make something where it's going to be freeze proof. So that'll definitely work. And but trapping in frozen ground, guys, is a pain. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. there is a method that Albert uses that I'm pretty sure is on YouTube, or it may be on one of the trapping episodes when we're down in Texas. And he shows a method he didn't come up with, he just does it in a different way, the power bedding method. And it'll allow you to bed a trap on top of the ground that is absolutely in pure stable. And you're using gutter nails, and you're using the lip of those gutter nails to put pressure on the trap in two different areas. If you go watch the video or talk to someone that knows about power bedding, you can see how that works. So if I was in, and I'm just telling you what I would, my first response would be to 6 inches of frozen ground. I would go with the power bedding method. I would use hay bale sets or grass or chaff sets of some kind. And, you know, where you have organic material like hay or something, you put your bait and stuff at the bottom of it. and then you spread that out so they're stepping on the hay, because even though it gets frozen, it still moves, it's pliable that way. And you put the trap, instead of bedding it in the ground under the hay, you power bed it on top of the ground so there's no soil whatsoever touching those springs and the jaws. And you can do that very easily with power bedding. And then you could put your hay bale set, or chaff or grass clippings, or if you're around somewhere that's done a lot of soybeans, you have those piles that are out in the wood, you know, out in the fields, you could move them or use them where they're at. Something like that, or you don't really want to use leaves if you even had them in Nebraska, because they'd blow around too much. But the premise, and you can get online and Google hay bale set and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. But it's a way then that the ground being frozen is irrelevant to the trapper, because the trap is literally sitting on top of the ground and he just has organic matter like hay or grass or straw or something that's over the trap. And even though you don't want to put so much over it that you can't see any part of the trap, but a coyote, even as smart as they are, they're very susceptible to that set because it's a very natural thing. There's no pattern for them to key off of. There's no point of entry or exit for them to key off of. And it really works off of them spending a lot of time at the set. And if you're putting your traps on top of the ground instead of in the ground in a set like that, I would put two or three traps around the hay bale, so no matter which way they come in and work it, there's a good chance they're going to end up in your trap. And that's an old way of dealing with the cold weather like that. A lot of the issues come with the cold weather is when somebody's trying to use a fall system in winter, and they're trying to force something that works in good weather to work in bad weather. And you kind of get in trouble this way. Now, his last question is, how do I get information on your online business course? I'm interested in taking it. Now, what I'm going to do for you is I'm going to go and put that in the section of my email, so you'll have first shot of getting it since you sent the email. We're getting pretty close to being full on this course. And I'm going to have, before the radio show tonight, there's going to be a thing on the business course. And if you want to be in the business course, you're going to be getting an email from me. But if you haven't sent me an email yet to be first in line, the way that we're going to handle this is because there's going to have to be a password and a username. And it's going to be easier if I have that instead of you putting it in there than you losing it. And there's only going to be a certain amount of people doing it. The way I'm going to take payment for that is only one way. If you send a check, I'm not taking it. And I'll explain to you why inside of the course I'm doing this. Is a postal money order, not something you get at Walmart or anything. A postal money order for $299. You send that to me, and inside the envelope, it's got your name, your email address, your phone number. What are you thinking about that you're wanting to do in business? Doesn't have to be a full book or anything, but just kind of so I can get an interest with it. And I'll need to know your email, because once I get back from Michigan, I'm going to be sending out emails to the people that are going to be in the course with one quick way that you can make your money back from taking the course really quick. Because $299 is not a lot. So if you're one of the guys that want to take the business course, you need to send a postal money order for $299. No other type postal money order will be accepted. I will send it back. And I'll explain to you inside the course of why I'm doing that. But that's just the way that it's going to be on this. This is not something I'm going to take a credit card for. If you want to take a chance on sending cash, you can, but if it gets lost, dude, that's kind of on you. So I wouldn't suggest that. But a postal money order for $299, that'll actually lock you into the course, besides the ones I've taken emails from, which I'm going to put this email in there. And then once that levels out, I can see how many more left. When it hits 50, it's gone. And then right after the first of the year is when we're going to start actually doing the course part. But I want to have an email that you need to write down for me where it's legible, so I can send you how you can make your money back and actually have a business based off of, it'll cost you maybe, well, a trapper shouldn't cost more than about 10 bucks. And the business model I'm going to give you for free, actually, my CPA thinks he can buy property and pay for it in 2 years off of this. So you can make a lot of money with it, or you can make as much as you need to make with it just to get through at certain times or to pay for the course. But I need to have that in there. So $299 sent to Clint Locklear at 65 Watson Road, Dunlap, Tennessee, 37327, postal money orders only will be accepted, and we'll get started in January once the holidays and all that stuff's over with. All right, well, I think that's more than long enough. Actually, I had like 7 emails and we're an hour and 20 minutes into it, and I think I covered one. So, great questions, very thoughtful. I enjoy doing this, guys. If you're already trapping, wear them out. And if you hadn't started trapping yet, get yourself ready to wear them out. So let's go out there and have some fun, get some frost on us, and a little bit of dirt under our fingernails. And remember what it's like to actually be a male instead of a fake male that most Americans are today. All righty, see y'all.